Tom Hayden was asking me about sort of the commonalities of our keynote speakers tonight, and having met Sherry Konkola maybe 15 years ago at an event somewhat like this, it was a little bit earlier in the stages of the development of this movement, I can tell you that one commonality that I see is that we have a lot of conspirators up here, some dangerous people, and thankfully they're on our side. You'll be hearing from me quite a bit over the next couple of days, so I will just say this. This movement is a movement for power. It's not a movement for a greater share of the pie. We want the whole pie. We want the kitchen. Has taken some time to build. It has been built deliberately by many people, many of you in this room, over time. There were some of us and some of you and some other people who wish they could be here who were involved, I would say, in the genesis, maybe the conception of the movement, in the lead up to the protests in Seattle.
That's right.
And then for me, I see those protests in Seattle, and I'm guessing there's some veterans of that victory over corporate capital, we're here today. I see those protests in Seattle as the birth of this movement. And that young child had some difficult first steps. There was this little election the following year that became a Supreme Court decision. And then again in 2004, we once again had a fight over the right to vote, with the Supreme Court saying, no, you have no constitutional right to vote in 2000, and then we had the fight again in 2004. And this moment right now, for me, is the moment in which this movement for democracy in the United States has reached maturity. We have become visible. We are proof that there is a movement that is calling for radical democratic reforms in this country, so that if the goodwill of the American people, the people who wish us well around the world, can be reflected in policy. So that all the things we know that we need to do, raise taxes on the rich, two-thirds of the American people know that's what we need to do, can actually come to pass. So for me personally, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for making this movement happen, for your commitment in coming here, for the work that you're going to do in the coming weeks and months, and especially actually in the next couple days. There will be announcements at every session. Please pay attention to those. If you can help out, please do. And now I'm just, as I said, I'm talking plenty over the next couple days, and I'll tell you, I haven't slept much. I think I've slept since Sunday. I'd like to introduce another person for whom, for me, and I think for many people, not so much he personally, but his writing was an icon, was iconic. The Port Huron Statement was drafted some 50 years ago, and it became, in time, not only the mandate for a generation, but the mandate for subsequent generations. I was telling Tom Hayden on the way down here, he made me pull off the road and visit his old family home in Oconomowoc. And I was trying to talk with him about politics, and he just wanted to see the old Wisconsin that he remembered. But I was telling him that the Port Huron Statement for activists of my generation, which is to say the 1990s, the Xers who made Seattle happen, I'm proud of my generation. The Port Huron Statement was still mandatory reading for student activists. And he asked, well, "What's why? You know, why do people say?" Why do people say that this is something that everybody has to read? And I honestly, Tom, you seemed a little bit skeptical. Is that right? A little skeptical. I said it had nothing to do with him. It had to do with what he wrote. That unfortunately, the call for participatory democracy, the call for America to live up to its greatest promise, has still not been achieved, and for my generation, as for his generation, as for the people who I now teach across the street at Madison College, the promise of American democracy has still not been achieved. And I want to say to you, Tom, it's a hard legacy, it's a hard life you've had to lead to have created a work that was so great so early in life. You might many of you, if you're not on his mailing list, you will know that, you won't know that Tom Hayden is actually very much involved in the peace movement. Remember that movement? It was popular until the 2008 election, and then somehow it disappeared from MSNBC, the New York Times, and so on. He has remained active in all kinds of causes throughout his life, but really, it is the Port Huron Statement itself that is the reason why we invited Tom Hayden to come here as the person who helped to reintroduce the idea of participatory democracy to people who had been shut out of the political process. Please welcome Tom Hayden.
I'm sort of an outside listener more than an outside agitator, and very uncomfortable to arrive here from California, admiring all that you've done this year and over the years, but particularly this year, and not having a chance to hear your voices, your questions, your comments, your feedback, but just walking into a hotel room to speak. So forgive me if I just share some random responses to what I think might be some of your questions. There's a couple of workshops in the morning that will be more open forums and discussions, and I would love to see you there. One of my habits as an organizer is to try to build a list of email contacts in the cities I go to, because I send out a bulletin called the Peace and Justice Bulletin. It attempts to give original information on the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, the war on gangs, the war on crime, the war on young people, the war on drugs. We've got a lot of wars going in this country that need monitoring and opposition. And people all around the country in 60 cities are on these lists. I won't give them to any other organizations or individuals. I won't send them to anybody, but you'd honor me if you would take this and circulate it. And whatever hand you use to write, be a little careful. It becomes difficult to read the handwriting when people go into their addresses. You notice that? It's just kind of a problem. Secondly, I just wanted to say that I try to leave behind books, really cheap books. At about 10 or 20% of the publisher's rate, and they're outside, and I'll be glad to try to come outside after this, and I hope that you'll buy the book so you can take home something in the way of further material to study. I wanted to also thank very much the Call for Peace Drum and Dance Company, wherever they are. Thank you again. It's of special interest to me, this subject. I'm married to a descendant of the Oglala people who were forced to migrate into Canada and become immersed in the First Nations. And I spent a lot of time on these issues. As a matter of fact, I've just finished a long research project that tries to show how the General Petraeus's Manual on Counterinsurgency goes back through a whole series of army manuals on counterinsurgency that take you through the history of the wars of annihilation and counterinsurgency against people in this area, people in the plains, people in the southwest. Counterinsurgency might end in Afghanistan some fine year, but it began in Native America. It began in this continent, and it is a military doctrine that should be repugnant to anybody that really knows our history and what its actual intentions are. I approached the issue of democracy from that perspective that I think many of you share. On my family's other side, I'm an Irish-American Catholic, and so we have a strong attachment to the political opportunities that were afforded us as immigrants, illegal, undocumented immigrants to this country back decades and centuries ago. On the other hand, I'm also painfully aware that the Irish-Americans, like many other European descendants, got into a collision course with the native people and became Indian fighters in these areas. I come from Oconomowoc. And so democracy for me is a fragmented concept that requires some kind of constant improvement, and improvement requires an understanding of the first facts, not a glossing over. And the fact is that the democratic structures that we have built are built on the destruction of original inhabitants and original landscapes and ecosystems here in North America. Anything less than that understanding will result in a continuation of the democracy that some of us are proud of and the rest of the world is very skeptical of. So it's just as a practical matter, I think we have to have that historic understanding. Now, my family comes from Oconomowoc. I tried to see it today. Paul had to go shake some hands, good for him. But I wanted to mention that I couldn't find the original Oconomowoc today because we were in a hurry, but also it is mauled over. It's unbelievable. Every time I go there, there's a new strip, very handsome buildings. They seem to have been put in last night, though there's a kind of a very glossy modernism about them. And because my family came from Oconomowoc, I spent all my summers here growing up before graduating at the University of Michigan, I was very much immersed in some parts of the state's political history, especially populism, and my family would divide fairly evenly between Joseph McCarthy and Robert La Follette types. So I would be, I guess if I was among you this past year, you'd put me down as an undecided voter, looking at the demographics. And I do think that this conflict between progressive and reactionary forms of populism should be at the heart of politics, and certainly has always been at the heart of social movements. In my study and participation in social movements, I've developed a little theoretical description, but it always ends in these two forms of populism. They begin in mysterious ways at the far margins of the social order. They arise and go through trials before they pass through transformative moments and enter the mainstream and slowly march towards majority status. If they come from movements before, if they echo what we feel is somehow our natural identity, they succeed in time, sometimes over 100 years, rarely overnight, but they succeed as they become a majority and they achieve their original goal, which could be collective bargaining rights or voting rights or all of the other achievements of social movements down through the centuries in our country. And at precisely the moment they achieve their goal, they are met with new quandaries, because on the one hand, the movement itself divides between pragmatic people who want to secure the victory and people who've been radicalized by the process and now want more than the right to vote, more than a cup of coffee, etc. And this is an inevitable pattern I'm describing, as far as I can tell, not easily curbed, but the more we know about it, we may tolerate these divergences. And within the establishment or the ruling class or the powers that be, whatever you want to call it, they too divide in the course of the struggle between more moderates who, in order to save the system, and because they've become sympathetic over time with some of the goals, they say, let's make the concession. Women want to vote? Fine, let them vote. Fine with me. It only taken 100 years, but I'm tired of being beaten up and seeing women being tortured in front of the White House, so they should have the right to vote. The other side of the divide in that Machiavellian ruling circle are the absolutists, the fundamentalists, who believe that every concession to the democratic social movement is a loss of their status, a loss of their power, a loss of their future, and therefore they fight even more intensely than they did before when they were certain of their comforts. They form a ferocious counter-movement that attempts to attack the achievement and to roll it back. And while that happens, the movement itself is subject to being fragmented by victory. And is this familiar to anybody in Wisconsin? I don't think it's universal to the whole earth, but it is my experience that when you win, your base can demobilize or split, and the other side can become more extreme or intense because they perceive that they have more to lose. That's the story of the Tea Party's rise and its confederates going back over time, because they are obviously trying to roll back laws achieved long ago in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and elsewhere, but also laws achieved in the 1960s. In California, public employees were not recognized until the 1960s, but also laws that go back to the earlier 60s and back to the 30s and back to the populist movement, back to the days when labor was considered a conspiratorial and illegal form of association. So somehow the counter movement has, in my experience, more intensity and more memory, perhaps because it has more institutional backing and more money than the social movement, which is apt to fragment. And so the struggle for memory as a precondition for a better future becomes more and more and more important to me. It's not a matter of my getting older and seeing 50 years behind me. It's more a matter of knowing that movements are built upon previous movements, and that there are some who want to eliminate that memory, so we have to start from scratch, as I pretty much did 50 years ago. There are others who want to glamorize it and make it a legacy that everybody bows to. There are others who I think of as the politicians of memory, who want to manipulate the achievement and name highways after it, if you know what I mean. I came here in 1961 to a student meeting, and I was transformed in the mystical way that I have mentioned to you by the encounter I had with African-American students from the South who were looking for allies in the North. At the time, I was a student editor, University of Michigan, and close to friends of a lifetime from the Daily Cardinal. And it was this encounter as a young man that I think made me the kind of radical thinker and activist, and above all, investigative reporter, I guess, that I still am today. It was a blessed moment, 60 to 62, and it's quite forgotten. The Port Huron Statement, written in Port Huron, Michigan, was about participatory democracy. And even then, we made a distinction between participatory democracy and representative democracy. What was the relationship? On the one hand, as powerless students without the right to vote, democracy was just something out there. And as participants in the Freedom Rides and in the direct action, we came to understand that there was a participatory kind of democracy that could affect the institutions and change small things and large. The word came from John Dewey on down to Arnold Kaufman, who was a professor of mine at the University of Michigan, who said to we young radicals, there's a big difference between a democracy based on participation and one that is based on electing people. You'll find that out. Well, what we found out was it was very complex and not simplified, but in a word I would say that social change begins with democratic participation at the margins and grows, and is later absorbed, for better and for worse, by representative democracy. John Lewis and I, and maybe a handful of others, are the only people I know that went into electoral politics from jail. We decided we would get the jail out of the way before we went to office. Others have chosen the reverse path, as you can understand. So I went from Mississippi and Georgia and Ann Arbor into, I volunteered for a community organizing project. That's why I'm anxious to hear what Jerry has to say about the Poor People's Movement, because we thought that out of the direct action in the South and the breaking of the grip of segregation over the voting process, we could combine civil rights and anti-poverty through a process based on community organizing, just somewhat, I think, the way the liberation theology movement started in Latin America, going door to door, living in voluntary poverty, and turning the apparent nothingness of apathy into the vitality of community organizations based on people who had no previous organizational experience, but learned that they could be empowered by learning how to organize and assert themselves. And it was amazing. We were prepared to give our lives, or give at least a decade, and we went off with no money and found apartments and lived on a couple dollars a day, eating rice and trying to be even poorer than the poor. The poor actually were starting to be critical of us because they wanted to be middle class and we were trying to be distant from the middle class, but that was all worked out. In any event, hundreds of us went to northern ghettos and barrios and to Appalachia to complement Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party organizing in Mississippi. And if you look at the Port Huron Statement, you'll find no mention of Vietnam except a single word, because we felt that we were on the way towards a domestic democratic revolution in the United States across racial and class lines, and with an uneasy but practical relationship with the Kennedy administration. Vietnam was the farthest thing from our minds. Then two things happened that were etched in our lives forever. One was the factor of assassination. Most movement models and theories do not include assassination as a major variable. But from my experience with the Kennedys and King and Malcolm X and many others, assassination was the variable of the 1960s experience. And people have been in denial about trying to analyze how it set things back. But in one sentence, I'll tell you this. We were denied the possibility of building a successful, progressive majority movement that would come to power electorally and in unions and in community-based organizations to test how far democracy could be utilized in achieving profound democratic, economic, social change. Never know. We became might have been's. The second thing we were blind to, I should have learned from William Appleman Williams' books and lectures that the unique character of America is its so-called frontier culture, expansion culture. Those are fairly antiseptic words for killing and plunder and robbing and thieving, but you know what I mean. His theory, in a nutshell, was that the United States had the unique opportunity to divert class and social conflict by channeling people on the frontier all the way across the Indian Wars to the West Coast, then to Japan, all the way to the wars of my lifetime, which seemed very much to me broken treaties and violent genocidal attacks on native people organized in tribal societies from Vietnam to Iraq to Afghanistan to Libya to Yemen to Somalia. So it's not over, but Vietnam was unexpected. I actually believe now, having studied it for 50 years, that it was a tactical maneuver. Other people think it was the nature of our system. I just don't know. But what happened in 64 is our hope and dream for a progressive majority was demolished by two things: the refusal of the Democratic Party, despite Wisconsin's objections, to seat the Mississippi Freedom Democrats, and in the same month, the Tonkin Gulf operation that was secretly held from the American people for years that sent us into Vietnam. We did not know in 1964 that 100 or 150,000 of us would be facing a draft in 1965. And so any hope of civil rights in the North or economic progress against poverty evaporated because simply because of the diversion to war and the absorption of funding that could have been used at home into the machinery of death of so many tens of thousands of people. And to put this in perspective, we have to ask whether the same thing is not happening today. What I'm saying is this, and let me just say it briefly. I started as a young man in Ann Arbor and Atlanta and Macomb, Mississippi and Madison in my travels, thinking that we were going to foster a democratic American reform or radical reform or social revolution. And wound up realizing that everything I was trying to do by knocking on doors to end poverty, end discrimination, build housing, garbage collection, rent control, all of those efforts again and again through my 50 or 55 years are always dissipated because of the escalation of a foreign war. Like nowhere else on the planet is there a country which, with so much democratic potential, that has somehow, I'll leave it to you to analyze why, but it somehow always squanders its potential on war. So what I would add to the issues that were raised this summer, and I followed Wisconsin from afar by phone. I chose not to come here after being asked to because I thought the outside agitator thing would be probably a foolish diversion, but now I'm here. I want to say there'd be no solution to the budget problems of Wisconsin or California without an end to the war in Afghanistan. It has taken a long time. But did you know that on August 3rd, the AFL-CIO came out against the war in Afghanistan? Now you could say, well, that's a little late. Or you could say the glass is half full. I prefer the glass is half full because it means that organizations in the labor movement and its allies are free now to use resources, to use organizing resources, to link the issues. These are trillion-dollar wars, and that money is not coming back. And you have to be a lunatic to be a war hawk and a deficit hawk. But that's what we're governed by. People who say, let's reduce the deficit by spending more money in foreign countries. You wonder, what? We're beyond reason here. Friends, reason should be applied, but it's very important to reach the people in the middle and the people who are wondering where the money will come from, to say that the military budget, and particularly the long war, which is a Pentagon doctrine, by the way, calling for an 80-year war, we're only in the 10th year of it, it runs through Muslim countries where there might or might not be terrorists, where there happens to be a lot of oil as well. And it's modeled on the Cold War. It's an undeclared war, but it's an official doctrine. So the long war is the concept that should be opposed by every rational person worried about their standard of living, their foreclosure questions, the affordability of college for the students at the University of Wisconsin or California. And it's quite interesting to me that no one in American politics has the guts to either advocate the long war, which is an official Pentagon doctrine, or oppose it. So it's the elephant in the room, and I don't mean the Republican Party. God bless those of you who are Republicans. It's the elephant in the room. So that's what I am here to say, that the domestic effects of the long war are the closure of civil liberties and the reduction of discretionary funding for anything you want to build in Wisconsin. And to the question of whether if we cut back on Afghanistan, we'll be attacked by terrorists, I have to say, I don't know the answer to that question, but if that's the only question you have, The answer is maybe, maybe not, but I can guarantee you there's no way to coexistence with the Islamic world by bombing the hell out of their children and families and devastating their societies. If you want to provoke a terrorist attack, that's the way to do it. It's going to be a... long war is going to require a long peace and justice movement. But there are steps along the way. Just as in the 50s, I thought I lived in an age of apathy, but there was the Montgomery bus boycott. There was Little Rock. Do you know we had a Republican president who sent troops into Little Rock to enforce an integration order? But I was brainwashed into thinking, even though I was part of the Beat Generation, that it was a time of apathy. I didn't notice these precursors in the Beat Generation or in the Deep South. They were seemingly isolated, marginal events. In the same sense, I would suggest to you from afar that what happened in Wisconsin this year is a similar precursor of great events ahead.
Maybe 100,000 people in the streets of Madison, Wisconsin is nothing compared to what's to come. I want to let you know that Tom asked me on the way here, he said, what are we going to do during question and answer? And I said, there is no time for question and answer tonight. And he was very disappointed. But there will be an opportunity to have a conversation with him tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. And so I want to make a correction to the program. This was actually added at the very last of the program that went to the printer yesterday morning. That session with Tom Hayden and Paul Buell, another SDS veteran, is actually tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., not on Friday. It's listed, it's the same room, it's just tomorrow morning, not on Friday.
Well, what room is it though?
I don't have a program in front of me, so look in the program. And please, if that's one of the sessions that you would like to go to, know that it is tomorrow morning and Thursday, not on Friday.